New data from the CDC shows Iowa's suicide rate increased more than 35% in 17 years. This hour, what's behind these alarming statistics? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we get several perspectives. We'll hear from an ER doctor, also from an Iowa mother who lost her son to suicide, from the executive director of NAMI Iowa, and from a psychotherapist about what you can do when a loved one is severely depressed. Share your experience as we discuss suicide prevention and access to state mental health services. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Suicide in this country is a major public health issue. In 1 year, just 1 year, 2016, it accounted for nearly 45,000 deaths in 2016 alone. That's why the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta decided to take a comprehensive look at suicides over a longer period. The period they looked at was 1999 to 2016. And when they did, it revealed that suicide rates have increased in nearly every state over the past two decades. Half of the states have seen suicide rates go up more than 30%. Iowa is among those states with dramatic increases. Iowa's suicide rate increased more than 35% in 17 years. This hour, we want to have several perspectives on what's behind these alarming statistics. In just a moment, we'll hear from an ER doctor, also from the executive director of NAMI Iowa, and a little later from a psychotherapist here in Iowa. Give us some tips that may seem counterintuitive to you about what you can do. And no, you don't have to be a professional to help out a loved one. What you can do when a loved one is severely depressed. Also this hour, we want to have you share your thoughts, your experience as it pertains to our discussion of suicide prevention and access to state mental health services. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Of course, because of this topic, we do want to give out that valuable suicide, National Suicide Prevention Hotline here at the start, and we will later in the program. If you or a loved one are in crisis, 1-800-273-8255. That's a free confidential support line for people in distress, for loved ones of people in distress. Turn to it. Make use of that National Suicide Prevention Hotline. Joining us, first of all, Mary Neubauer is with us, a resident of Clive, Iowa. And Mary, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Ben. Thank you so much for discussing this topic today.
Well, I have you to thank for being on this program because you are willing to talk about extremely painful loss. You lost your son, Sergey, to suicide, and that was last year.
Yeah, Sergey unfortunately died in September after wrestling with mental illness for months, if not years. And I personally know the toll that it takes on a family and, unfortunately, the lack of resources that we found here in Iowa. It was just heartbreaking for Larry and me as Sergey's parents to watch this vivacious, you know, fun-loving, outgoing kid just really disintegrate in front of our eyes. And no matter how much we helped or how much we loved him, we just couldn't stop it from happening. And it was a terrible episode. But I realized that by the end of Sergey's life, when he did take his own life, we were so frustrated because we'd been living in that horrible situation and under that stress for months, if not years, and we hadn't said anything. And it just hit me that if none of us tell our stories, how do we ever expect other people to understand and to empathize and to want to help? And so we made the decision to talk about Sergey, to talk about his his struggle and our own family struggle in the hope that we can make things better for others. And that's what we've continued to do in all the months since.
Mary, thank you and your husband for that courageous decision to break down the taboos. That is one of the keys, I understand, of improving the treatment of chronic depression and also those who seek to take their own lives. So tell us a little bit about the chronology of this and reading about your son. He sounds like he was just a tremendous kid. And in fact, you adopted him as an orphan from Russia, right? Back in 2009.
Yeah. Yeah, we adopted him in 2009. He was an older orphan living in an orphanage in the Karelia region of Russia, which is clear up by Finland. And so we got to go to Russia twice in that process. Sergei was 11 when we had adopted him. And so we knew his life was not all sunshine and roses, obviously, because he had been in an orphanage in Russia. And so he was such a smart kid and athletic and outgoing. He was conversational in English within 4 months, which mm-hmm. is just incredible. And so as soon as he could speak English, we started going to family counseling with him because we knew that he would have, you know, things from his past that he would need to deal with. I don't think anyone knew the extent of what Sergei had suffered in his young life until years later. I think he was the only person who truly knew the extent of it. He did share those details with Larry and me in the last year of his life, and all of that trauma in those formative years just is what took the huge toll on him. And we've come to learn so much about that, certainly while Sergei was alive and in the months since, that trauma has a direct correlation to brain health and brain function and what that will do to a person, particularly in their adult years. And I think that's such an important part of the conversation for the public to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. What were the first signs, Mary, you had that you were dealing with a major mental health issue with Sergei?
You know, early on in his time with us, even when he was 11 years old, he would scream in his sleep, but he wouldn't wake up. Those are night terrors, and clearly we knew that was something that we needed to pay attention to, and that was something that we immediately addressed in counseling. And then, honestly, he did really well for years. He was a gifted athlete. He could sit down and draw whatever was in front of him. He did well in school. He was bilingual, just an incredible kid. But then as his teenage years progressed, it became obvious that he was struggling. He tried to harm himself multiple times. The depression was there. It was clear. He was having full-blown panic attacks that were just so incredibly awful for us to watch him go through and help him go through, let alone being the person going through it. And so there were a lot of warning signs that we were very well aware of, and we were doing everything we could to help. But, you know, sometimes it's just too much for a person to overcome. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. that was the case for Sergei.
Mary, we wanted to have some others in the discussion before we introduce some others here. I wanted to have you expand on your comment about the lack of resources. What resources were lacking that you and your husband, Larry, wished you had had for Sergei?
You know, we were very lucky in that we had a wonderful family counselor and regular counselor who Sergei met with. And when he needed emergency care here in Iowa, at the very height of his crises, we were able to get that emergency care. But then it was obvious that Sergei needed long-term residential mental health care if he was to have a chance to develop those long-term skills that he would need to deal with his depression, anxiety, PTSD, and there simply wasn't any that we could find in Iowa. We searched the entire country over to try to find the right fit for him and ultimately found a great facility in Arizona where he was a patient and did well there and then went on to another facility in California. But the fact that he was half the country away from us when he was going through treatment just made it that much harder on our family, you know, in terms of trying to maintain the relationship and make sure that he knew we supported him and were thinking about him. That's just hard to do when we're in Iowa and he was in Arizona and California.
Mary, we are so grateful to have you in on this conversation, to open up others to conversations on radio, but also mostly, you know, among themselves in families. This is really what has to happen. Mary, stay on the line.
Okay.
If you just joined us, Mary is a resident of Clive, lost her son, Sergey, to suicide in 2017. Dr. Hans Haus is with us in the Iowa City studio. He's a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Iowa, an ER physician. Dr. Haus, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me here today.
We're turning to you because a lot of our acute mental health issues are winding up in ERs. I wanted to have you give us, first your reaction to the CDC statistics that we had there, that Iowa's rate of the suicide rate has gone up dramatically, as have many other states. Is that any surprise to you when you saw those statistics?
It's not a surprise at all, unfortunately. And in the emergency department, in the ER where I work at the University of Iowa, we're seeing the effects of that. We're seeing the end result of all those patients coming in, seeking and trying to get help. Sergey's story that Mary told is tragic and terrible and unfortunately far too common. And we have trouble getting those patients. We can get them in the emergency department. We have trouble then getting them out and into an inpatient facility or into an inpatient bed where they need long-term treatment. And that's our biggest challenge. I'll give you one example. We had this young child from a very difficult home, challenging home situation, really couldn't be at home. And unfortunately, he had become violent. And he was brought into our ER. And we took care of him, and we didn't have a place for him to go. Our hospital was full. All the surrounding hospitals were full. We didn't have an inpatient bed for him to go to, so the patient sat. The patient sat in our ER. The patient sat in our ER for 130 hours,
wow,
over 5 days. That's sitting on a gurney, a young child, and we didn't even go. While we were here, while the patient was here, we even had a bed open in our psychiatric hospital at the university, but they couldn't take the patient because the patient was too dangerous for other patients. And unfortunately, all we could do was continue to look for a residential facility. And that lack of an inpatient long-term facility that Mary described for Sergey is a terrible situation, and it backs up through the hospitals, and then backs up into our ERs.
Mm-hmm. Are other states doing it better than we are here in Iowa?
Iowa is dead last in terms of inpatient beds, state hospital beds per capita. That's a real challenge. That's a result of decades of closing inpatient facilities and not adequately funding mental health care. And now we're seeing the effects of that.
Mm-hmm. And the hope was, the promise is that community facilities, longer-term healthcare facilities in various communities instead of larger institutions would step up. And this has happened, or not to the degree that we need it to?
Way back in the day, back in the battle days, we had asylums. We had giant institutions where we would put lots of mentally ill patients. They were horrible situations. They were not that was not good treatment. So we closed asylums, and the idea was people were going to get treated in the community. And maybe for a while this worked, but as mental health facilities became underfunded or were cut or were closed, those resources dried up. And the number of people living in Iowa, people living in this country, grew. And then eventually ill people grew. And eventually you get to a tipping point where there isn't adequate facility. If you try to call for an appointment at our clinic at the university, you're going to have to wait 6 months for an available opening. That's not adequate.
You have an acute case, a son or daughter, a young person really in dire need of help, and they'll be put on a waiting list that lasts 6 months.
Your only other option is to come see me in the emergency department, and a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm. We also asked you on this program, Dr. Haus, because you posted on your Facebook page earlier this month. You alluded to it, and just you spelled out that one case. This is not an isolated case. You put a chart with a number of patients waiting in the ER on one, was this one shift?
So any given day, we have 4 to 6 patients. Any given moment, we have 4 to 6 patients, 4 or 5 patients waiting in our ER, waiting for an inpatient bed. one particular day, we had a lot. And I took a screenshot of our electronic health board showing that we had 14 people sitting in the ER for more than 24 hours, sometimes, and a few of them are up to 50 hours, waiting for that inpatient bed. They're just sitting on a gurney in our ER. And those are beds that we normally would use for people with an acute emergency, people coming in with a heart attack or stroke. There's less space now that we have to take care of acute cases because we have people just sitting around.
And people sitting around in dire need also need to be supervised. That takes personnel as well.
And that's not really good treatment. You're already mentally ill. Sitting on a gurney at ER in a noisy, busy emergency department is not a good way to get treatment.
Mm-hmm. Let me get your reaction to the new mental health law that was passed by the Iowa legislature. Let me turn to you, Mary. Some advances there? Are we taking some steps forward, in your opinion?
I think that the law put in place a framework for work to be developed and programs to be created. And so was it an important step forward? Absolutely. It hasn't solved the problem yet because all of that work still needs to be done. But from my perspective, one of the most important points in that law is that it does lift the cap on subacute care, which is what the ER doctor and I are talking about, which is that long-term residential mental health care. It lifts the cap on that and allows hopefully more of those programs to be created in Iowa. And then the other huge thing that we were looking for when we were trying to find help for Sergey was some sort of referral program, because we worked with wonderful health care providers who wanted to help, but when we would say to them, where can Sergey go? Where is a program that can help Sergey? They just didn't know. And I can't imagine that for any other health situation that you would have. If it was heart disease or cancer or a broken leg, of course people would know the specialist that you could go to. And so one of the facets of the bill is that it will create a state referral program, a number that people can call when they're looking for help. And I hope that that will provide a resource for people that we were not able to find when Sergey was struggling.
Dr. House, your thoughts on the new mental health law?
I agree with Mary. It is a step in the right direction, but it's not nearly enough, and we have a long way to go.
Outline a little bit of what improvements it did make, in your view.
Changing funding priorities is the big one, and I think allowing, as she described, lifting that cap so that there is actually funding available for long-term care, and that's one of the big limitations that we have, and that's what a number of our facilities have closed. I do have some hope for the future because I know of at least two, maybe three centers that are actually being built or being opened this year or next, which would be the first time in decades that Iowa has actually expanded the number of inpatient beds rather than decreased. So that's actually starting to slowly turn the ship.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hans House is with us of the University of Iowa, an ER physician. Mary Neubauer with us as well. She and her husband lost their son, Sergey, to suicide last year. Join our conversation if you have an experience or a question to share. 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Returning to our program, Peggy Huppert is with us, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness for Iowa. Peggy, welcome back to our program.
Having me.
Let's have you comment on a couple of things here. We'll keep you on through the break, of course, but your reaction to the CDC study over 17 years.
It just, like Dr. Hass, it didn't surprise me. It's alarming. I was happy to see the director of the CDC say we need to start treating this as a public health emergency, because in my view, it is. 45,000 people a year are taking their own lives. That's very alarming.
45,000 per year. Think
right.
about that. Yeah.
Right. That's a 50% increase since in over 18 years. It's over a long period of time, but still, you know, it's a marked increase. The other thing that there's a few other things that jumped out at me about it. Iowa still is pretty average in terms of it, both the increase and we're right in the middle in terms of suicide rate for the nation, but nationally, this study showed that about 40% of the people who took their own lives had no mental health diagnosis. Now, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health was quoted as saying, you know, if you did a study into each of those patients and you talk to their family members and you talk to a primary care doc, you would probably find that they in fact did have a mental illness that was undiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those people were males, and they were a member of a racial or ethnic minority. That's because the stigma is still so strong among certain groups of people, and you know, particularly males from ethnic and racial minorities, that they are not going to seek out treatment and help. Instead, they just kill themselves. And that's when you hear, wow, this is a complete shock. We had no idea. Usually the person has been suffering for some time, but they just weren't talking about it because they didn't feel they could. So that's something that we need to work on. We need to better equip family care doctors and emergency room doctors and others to know how to deal and treat with people with serious mental illness and with their family members.
Mm-hmm.
We're never going to have enough psychiatrists. We only have 121 psychiatrists in the entire state of Iowa and 137,000 people with chronic and serious mental illness. So you can do the numbers.
Right.
That's why we have, you know, 6-month waits to get in to see a psychiatrist. So we have to do a better job of equipping our other clinicians, our other doctors and registered nurse practitioners and physician assistants who can better help deal with helping people. And we need more of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to work on stigma. So that's why this program is so important. And for people like Mary and Larry and others to be talking about their situations, because the more we talk about it, the more that people will feel enabled and empowered to speak up about how they're feeling and to seek treatment.
Peggy Huppert is with us of NAMI, Iowa. Before we go to break in a couple minutes, I've been reaching out to our callers. I wanted to get our first caller on. Caleb is with us from Nevada, Iowa. Caleb, not much time here, but we're sure glad you joined the program. Do you have a question or comment?
I just wanted to comment. I have had numerous hospitalizations for severe depression and suicide attempts, and I was actually court-ordered to a facility in northwestern Iowa that I didn't receive adequate care. And I think a problem I've seen over and over again in hospitals and in just kind of a lot of places you go in the mental health field is just kind of a lack of care and empathy and compassion from some of the higher-ups in the mental health field.
Mm-hmm.
Of the psychiatrists who are running psych wards and things like that. And I think that has become a prevalent issue just in the overall
right. Just
kind of morale of people struggling.
Caleb, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're coming up on a break, and I wanted to get a reaction from Dr. House. What do you think about that comment, Dr. House?
I'm sure that people that Caleb has dealt with have been stressed by their situation and overtaxed by the number of patients compared to the resources they have, and I feel for them, and I think it's a challenging situation, but I'm sure that I'm glad that he's been trying to get help, and we'll hopefully he can use to get the help that he needs.
Okay, Caleb, thank you for calling from Nevada, and we sure hope you do get the help you need, continuing to seek it, even though we're hearing on this program it can be a frustrating experience. Dr. Hans House is a professor of emergency medicine and ER physician at the University of Iowa. Mary Neubauer lost her son, Sergey, to suicide in 2017. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about chronic depression, suicide prevention, and the access to mental health care in this state. I guess we're doing better. 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer this hour talking about suicide prevention, mental health care access in the state, and the lack thereof in many respects. Joining us, Dr. Hans Haus is a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Iowa, described in the first half hour how there's really a sore lack of, well, places to put people with acute mental health issues. Mary Neubauer is with us. Courageous that she is with us this hour to describe, talk about the loss of her son, 18-year-old Sergei, last year to suicide. Peggy Huppert, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Iowa. It's a big, big, major public health issue that we, many of us, don't even realize is taking nearly 45,000 deaths. That was in 2016 alone. That's why the Center for Disease Control and Prevention looked at a longer time span, 1999 to 2016, and looked at all the states. We in Iowa have had our rates go up by more than 35% in 17 years. Alarming statistics not only for Iowa, but for many states. So we're digging in, getting perspectives on this alarming trend to see why it's happening, and also what are the remedies. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Dr. Haus, you mentioned in the break, and I wanted to get this out there, a bright statistic as we sort of hopefully turn the corner in what has been pretty sad resources available for people with mental health issues in Iowa. The University of Iowa is opening up a new unit soon.
Yes, there was some research out of California that showed that having a crisis unit or an emergency stay, like an ER kind of thing, for psychiatry, for mental health crisis patients, can actually help and actually decrease the burden of inpatient beds across the whole system, and patients get out the door faster. One thing that we've seen in our own work at the university is that people wait in our emergency department so long that they're no longer suicidal or they're no longer psychotic. And they basically just sit around and they get better. We treat them through their acute crisis period. So later on this year, the university is going to be opening a crisis stabilization unit. So it's going to be a special ward of the hospital where once people are stabilized, they're going to go there to wait for their inpatient beds. And they're going to get treatment while they're there. We're going to start therapy where they're going to see psychiatrists. And hopefully, a lot of those patients won't need the inpatient treatment anymore, and we can get them treated in the clinic and get them out the door, and we're going to have more beds available.
Mm-hmm. How is this made possible in terms of funding, in terms of resources? How many beds are we talking about?
Well, this is out of the hospital budget. We're just using a place that we had for, it was actually formerly an ICU for children. Now we have the Children's Hospital. So we're going to use that available space now for this crisis stabilization unit. The money to pay for this just comes from having more beds in the emergency department. If we can get those patients out of the ER into a crisis unit, we're going to have more beds. We're going to see more people in the ER for acute problems, and we can really be there for what people need, which is when we're there for trauma and heart attacks and strokes and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones, go to Iowa City. Charlotte is with us in Iowa City. Hi, Charlotte. What's your angle on our discussion today?
Hi. I just want to tell you about my grandson. He took his life last year.
I'm
he
so sorry,
was a normal,
Charlotte.
Thank you very much. He was just a normal, happy 22-year-old, and then he started hearing voices and acting very strangely, and it came to a head about March of last year, and his family took him to the ER, and he was put in the psychiatric unit. The problem I see is they only kept him for 3 days. They diagnosed him with a thought disorder. They gave him medication and sent him home. Well, it turns out that he was extremely allergic to this medication, had a terribly severe reaction to it. And it took multiple phone calls to find anybody to talk to about it. And when his mother finally was able to get in touch with a doctor, he said, just tell him to quit taking it. That was it. There was no concern for follow-up care or changing of medication. And so that, to me, was extremely disappointing, just a lack of concern. And then the other thing, too, was because of his mental health, He lost his job. He wasn't able to return to work, and he had no insurance. His mother was trying to get him into a therapist, but they wouldn't make an appointment until he had some kind of insurance. So she was desperately trying to get him on Medicaid, and with the new Medicaid in Iowa, that's not an easy task for an adult. And in the meantime, he took his own life. So I see a couple of problems, the lack of follow-up, and then the problem with lack of insurance for people being treated for mental illness.
Charlotte, unfortunately, very sorry for the loss of your grandson. Not an uncommon theme, Dr. House, that we're hearing again here, Charlotte in Iowa City.
I think Charlotte highlights a lot of the features we've just been talking about, which is a lack of outpatient resources and a lack of clinical follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Jason Knight is with us as well. He's a clinical social worker and a psychotherapist in the Coralville, Iowa City area in our Iowa City studio. Jason, welcome to our conversation about suicide prevention and in light of the new statistics from the CDC. You just listened to Charlotte's story mm-hmm. there. And let's talk a little bit in the time that we have from you. I understand you've taught people mental health first aid. Now, we hear a lot about first aid, and but I've not heard this term, mental health first aid. What is it?
It's a program for helping to instruct people who are not mental health professionals how to help people who might be in a mental health crisis, how to help people tell their story, help break down some of the taboos, help to guide people into getting some of the resources that they might need, how to tell if somebody is having a crisis and how to broach the subject, you know, or in other words, how to ask the question if necessary.
Right. This is a huge gap in our awareness, our understanding. I have the feeling, I think there are a lot of well-informed listeners here who are ill-informed or just not informed about what you said. We were very uncomfortable in situations
Correct.
Where someone is withdrawn and doesn't want to share, and you have suspicions this person may want to take their own life. So give us some tips here.
So this is a subject that's really taboo. It's got a lot of stigma attached to it, and sometimes people get so afraid. They notice that somebody in their life is having trouble and withdrawing and experiencing symptoms that are concerning to them. And sometimes people are so concerned that they're going to say the wrong thing that they don't say anything at all. So one of the things to do, first of all, is to lead with concern. If you're noticing something happening with somebody who's important to you in your life, come up to them and be face-to-face with them if at all possible.
What would you use in terms of words?
I'm concerned. I'm seeing this. I'm worried about you. Can we talk?
And if you're brushed aside?
Sometimes that happens. That happens. You can be persistent. Usually, if you're expressing concern, that will put the brakes on being brushed aside.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in some common misperceptions here. For instance, we all want to get someone out of a very blue state, and perhaps those who have not experienced chronic clinical depression don't really understand what it is. So the natural thing to do is say, hey.
To attempt to cheer them up.
Right. That is not the right thing to do.
No, you want to hear them tell their story. The first thing I want people to do is to be present with the person and listen and express concern and ask how things are going and acknowledge what they're feeling.
Don't deny their reality.
Correct.
Why is that important?
It's important for them to tell their story, to get get what's going on out, rather than to deny it, because they've been bottling it up undoubtedly for some time now.
Mm-hmm. What about asking the question? Have you thought about what is the formula?
Yes.
Have you thought about killing yourself? Is that acceptable? Is that good?
It is absolutely acceptable. If you're getting a feeling from somebody that they're talking about death, they're talking about suicide, it is absolutely okay to ask them if they're feeling like killing themselves. You're not giving them a suggestion by asking that question. It's a way of broaching the subject in a way that can be extremely helpful.
Mm-hmm. And if someone expresses, yes, I have thought about killing myself.
Mm-hmm.
Or what do you do then?
The next thing you can do is you can ask if there's a how and a when, and if
the particulars, the specifics.
Correct.
Why do you need to know that? Why do you want to ask that?
it's important because then the next steps come into play. Then you want to know if they have a therapist, if there's somebody else that we can bring in onto the scene here, if they need professional help.
Mm-hmm. Peggy Huppert, does that sound like good advice to you? I mean, we certainly when we're lacking healthcare, mental health care professionals here, we have to all have some mental health first aid. So we have to be aware of it, Peggy, right?
Right. And I absolutely agree with that advice. I've experienced it in my own life. I've had several close family members with suicide ideation, meaning they're contemplating taking their own lives. We have to get past the idea that it's none of my business. I don't want to butt in. I don't want to make the person mad at me. Those are all fears that people have. And you can, many suicides, not all, but many are preventable. And especially when the person does not have a diagnosed mental illness. They haven't reached out for help. They haven't received any kind of diagnosis or treatment. Someone saying something to them can be the bridge that makes them feel like they can seek out help, and that's the most important thing because there is help and hope available.
Jason, back to you, and Peggy just alluded to it. When you are in the depths of a really dark black state, mm-hmm. you don't think there is any recovery. So what is,
right.
I mean, how do you use that in your psychotherapy stories of recovery? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of recoveries.
Absolutely,
out there.
Absolutely. Recovery is a dominant theme with a lot of really really deep depressions. Sometimes you need to explore how, because this may not be the first time somebody's been in a really deep depression. Sometimes there are other instances of, well, you know, there. How have you gotten through this in the past? What are some things that have helped you in the past? How can we? Are there other people in your life that we can bring in that we can use to help out? How can we reduce your feelings of isolation?
And isolation is a big thing. The single biggest thing that you can do to help is to be with the person.
Absolutely.
And not have them be alone. And I also want to say that the recent spate of celebrity suicides.
Yes.
Which just happened to coincide with the release of this report.
Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Within days of each other, were very hard on people who have attempted suicide and people like Mary who have had loved ones, lost loved ones, or your caller, because it is a trigger for trauma. And people say to me, you know, these people were rich and famous. They had everything. If they can't cope and get help, what hope do I have? You know, I'm just a loser. Because they are in a deep dark hole. So it's even more important to be sensitive to that and aware of it, and to reach out and offer that help and hope to anyone that you think might be in that situation.
Mary, was that a reaction? Was that a very difficult time when we did have those a lot of news about celebrity suicides?
Absolutely, Peggy is absolutely right on that. Obviously, I didn't know Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, but you know, Kate Spade's news came first, and it just hit me again, just in the heart, you know, like a ton of bricks. That here's another situation, a person who was suffering in silence and just couldn't find their way through it, followed by Anthony Bourdain, followed almost immediately by the news of the suicide rates from the CDC. It takes you back to that place that I thought I'd come so far from. It just brings the pain back to the surface, and I'm sure that's the case for so many, many people out there.
Right, and Mary, like these cases, apparently your son wore a mask, so to speak, and it was not clear in some cases to many of the people who knew him that he was suffering so much.
Oftentimes, you wouldn't know there was anything wrong with him. I was usually pretty good at being able to figure out when he was having a particularly hard time, but no one can guess 100% of the time. And Sergey did ask for help so many times. He obviously was in long-term mental health treatment. He went to crisis treatment. He went to residential treatment out of state. He tried and he tried, but he obviously just had a lot to overcome because of the abuse that he had suffered for years in his childhood before we adopted him. But that's not a subject for someone who's from another country. There are folks in this country who are suffering with all of those same issues. And so I completely agree with Peggy and Jason. Have the conversation. Do all you can to make sure that your loved one knows they're not alone and that you're there and that you care.
And Ben, I'd also like to add, we just had an experience here last week in Clive, Peggy Hubbard, with a Mercy Hospital proposing a new 100-bed inpatient psychiatric facility. And Clive hosted a community meeting on mental health. And I was at that meeting, and we had over 100 people turn out, most of whom were very much opposed to locating this facility in their neighborhood.
So here we have the expansion of a very much needed psychiatric facility near the Clive Aquatic Center, I understand.
Right.
And citizens turning up in droves to say, we don't want it?
Right.
And the reasons?
We heard things like the crazies are going to be wandering the street in the Greenbelt accosting people. They're going to assault children at the aquatic center. We don't want them near our kids. Those people will come on buses out there, and then they don't have transportation, and they'll be wandering around.
So, Peggy, we're running short of time. Address a person listening. There are undoubtedly many of them listening who would say, I can understand those concerns. I don't want it in my neighborhood. Can you say it's completely safe? Can you dispel those fears?
I absolutely can, and I'm sure our other people on the call could as well. They're unfounded. They're based on stereotypes. I said it's almost like people watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest last night and reacting to that perception of reality. It's every bad stereotype about mental illness that's ever been in popular culture, and in fact, there are inpatient and outpatient psychiatric facilities located all over that there are absolutely no problems with. And if we're going to expand services like we're talking about with the law that was just passed, people all over the state of Iowa are going to be asked to have these facilities near them. And I'm just hoping that Iowans will embrace this and understand the need for it and be willing to have it near them.
Okay, we have time for a few concluding remarks from our guests. Peggy Huppert there. Jason Knight, I see you vigorously reacting to that comment.
So one point I'd like to make is that people with chronic and persistent mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violence than they are to be perpetrators of any kind of violence.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good point. Dr. House, you're expanding facilities at the University of Iowa very soon, and this is painful to hear that when you jump through the hoops to get the facilities expanded, that there is still this stigma here.
We've been so desperate to expand facilities for so long, and I was very disappointed to read about the meeting that occurred in Clive. I read that in the press, and unfortunately, like I said, these are all stereotypes and myths. As we heard today on the show, we heard from the stories about people waiting for outpatient care, waiting for inpatient facilities, we need them, and we need more of them, and we need Iowans to support to that development.
Mary Neubauer, I want to give the last remaining minute or so to you. You lost your son, Sergey, to suicide in 2017, and bravely, courageously are with us today to talk about it so that we can dispel some of the taboo and let this be talked about. Worked for the AP before working for the Iowa Lottery. You found yourself writing your son's obituary, and you had some advice to close that obituary. Can you share a little bit of that before we say goodbye this hour?
Yeah, I did. As I've told people, I wasn't trying to start something when I wrote Sergey's obituary. I was just trying to honor my son, but that obituary has now been read more than 100,000 times, and I'm so especially proud that Sergey's story can impact others and hopefully make a difference. So I said in there, if you need help, ask for it. You know, can it be scary to take that step? No doubt, but you are not alone. And I said, seek to build each other up, not tear each other down. You know, I just think today, in society today, we're just so quick to get outraged and pile on and criticize people when
right.
we should be going the other way.
And we have social media where a lot of that is going on.
Exactly. And I said, avoid drama. You know, again, people are so quick to say they're outraged or it's the worst thing ever when it's really not that big of a deal. And I just said, you know, you only have so much energy and use it wisely. And then finally, you know, recognize small moments of joy because they truly are around us all the time and they happen all the time. We just have to notice. And sometimes I think we get so busy or caught up in things that we just slough those off or don't notice them. And so I'm really making an effort to be grateful and to take those moments of joy when they come.
Mary Neubauer, we are so grateful to have you on. No one can take away your and your husband's painful loss of your son, Sergey, but we do appreciate you being on this show and know that you have done a great deal of good by expressing your story and sharing your thoughts this hour.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Also joining us this hour, Peggy Huppert of NAMI, Iowa, Jason Knight, a clinical social worker and psychotherapist in the Iowa City, Coralville area. So thanks to Dr. Hans House of the University of Iowa. We had a lot of input that we didn't get to this hour. I apologize to the listeners who called or emailed and we didn't get to your input. This tells us that we need to follow up with the show in the near future. Thank you very much. And again, that National Suicide Prevention Lifeline for anybody, if you have any questions, 1-800-273-8255. It's free. It's confidential. 800-273-8255. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for listening.